The Undiscovered Self is the title that was given to this. It comes from a book by Carl Gustav Jung, and our indebtedness to him this morning is going to be fairly complete, but I think we should have a little bit of an idea of why we have chosen Jung, especially to help us through this problem of what is it about ourselves that is undiscovered, and why is it important. I think in a generalized way, we have to know and acknowledge that people bring not only gifts to the altars of the various disciplines, but they also bring petitions. They bring petitions to the altars of science in a generalized way, and to the various disciplines that are represented within that umbrella of science. Now, these questions that people bring are not always the questions that the people in the field are prepared to answer, nor are they the ones that the people in the field think are going to be the profitable ones for the future. But those petitions are being brought, and they must be heeded, because in a certain sense, each discipline has its own tradition. I suppose a kind, what we could call a hard tradition that's rooted in a scholarly pursuit, where scholarly pursuit is useful, and in other ways it's empirical studies. And that hard tradition, which is the interest of the scholars, generates hopefully the kinds of answers that people bring. We bring to these disciplines. We had that problem the other night when we were talking about the Science Committee's report, or we had a forum on the ethics of technology. Well, what is the relationship of science to technology? You know, there would be a good example of it. The hardcore research necessary to develop a technology is it makes this into two aspects of a given field. Now, what has happened in psychology is about like that. There is an enterprise in psychology, which is the hard, empirical-oriented kind, and then there is that which is softer. It asks or tries to respond to the softer questions, the kinds of things that perhaps pay out in the whole notion of personal adjustment. Now, these kinds of questions are instructive also for the people in the field. We've had questions asked of science to the point where we felt that science could answer questions on levels far beyond that which they were prepared to do. And this is beginning to become clear to many people, that the answers that science has offered does not provide a sufficient base for living out a life. And so what has happened is that psychology has been asked the question, is there more to life than what we are observing? Is there more to life than, for example, behavioral engineering, which would be one answer from a strictly hard-nosed scientific, behavioristic point of view, that what is basic in our whole enterprise, in the psychological enterprise, is how you behave, because thoughts come afterwards. Well, this has been not a satisfactory level of operating for many people. They ask, is this all there is? And the kinds of questions that are being asked now, strangely enough, are the questions of the inner world. Now I say strangely enough now, because we went through a time when those questions of the inner world were not being asked. And Jung, who was a contemporary of Freud back in the 19th century, was answering these inner questions and proposing possibilities for answering these questions, and was simply rejected by the psychological enterprise of the American system. Well, there's a disenchantment generally with science that has led us to the doorstep of Jung, who had insights that we think are particularly productive or potentially satisfying. I have another selfish reason for talking about the undiscovered self, not only because these questions are being asked. I should have said one other thing about this. People are being dissatisfied with the scientific empiricism, are saying, are there other sources of knowledge? The tremendous interest, which I think all of us can detect in the occult, in astrology, for example, in mysticism, in other thought processes beyond Western civilization. There's an enormous interest in Zen Buddhism now, for example. The relationship of the unconscious to the conscious processes.
how does that all work in? Is there a possibility that we in Western civilization have missed the boat in terms of sources of knowledge? Well, Jung was one of the first to introduce the Eastern philosophies to Western civilization, but he introduced it at a very unpopular time. It was at a time when we were rushing to still certify that we could capture this world on all of its levels through a control over the material elements of the world. And we were so preoccupied with dealing on the material level that Jung's voice coming from Europe was not heard too well, except ironically, here in America by one of the great industrialists, a fellow by the name of Mellon. And it's an ironic thing that Mellon supported much of Jung's work even to the more recent times. Well, that kind of question that is being asked, are there other sources of knowledge, other sources of information, other ways that we can get to know? Jung, in 50 years ago, was saying, you haven't listened altogether to the thinkers of this world. There are thinkers beyond European civilization that are worth listening to because they come directly to your level of experience. I have another selfish reason for choosing Jung. Unlike Freud, who said that most of the development in our life is established on themes that have stopped at around 5 or 6 years of age, that what you are is basically what you were then in terms of how you solved your psychological problems, and everything else is just simply variation. A marvelous time of life called middle age. And since I'm in that, and since a number of you are with me in it, take hope, we're going to talk about Jung. He's got something to say for us. He says, putting it together is not simply a childhood or even a childish enterprise. It's a thing of development. So thank goodness for that. Then a third selfish reason was the notion that Jung serves as a kind of prelude to some of the most exciting research, ironically done on an empirical level now, which is called the split brain research. Next week I'm going to be doing something on split brain. And some of these qualities of action that are not strictly rational are now going to become taking a very serious center stage now in the psychological investigation, also on an empirical level. All right, let's get into the what is this undiscovered self? We can think of it in several ways, also through the help of Jung. We can think of the way that we process this world. Each of us deal with the world that we're living with. We're dealing with it and acknowledge, perhaps, also from Jung's point of view, that the way each of us deals with this world might be quite insufficient. How we process the information. We've heard about these different constructs that we bring our agenda to any experience, our previous agenda to every experience, and that has much to say for it. But how we process this world, how we deal with the information that comes into it, is in many senses inadequate, according to Jung. We're going to talk about that. Are there ranges of experience beyond our present? Yes. How can we tap into them? Yes. This is what Jung says, that there are experiences far beyond our present one that is useful. Let me establish this, that we can think of this on a kind of a time continuum where the focus is on where I am right now. And the question that's raised is, how in the world did I get there? How did it happen that the way that I work in this world, the way that I behave in this world, the way that I think, the way that I love and hate, and how I make a living, how did I get there? Well, the strictly hard-nosed scientific answer is, we can tell you how you got there just simply by looking back into your personal pool of experiences. We'll go back to your childhood. We'll go back to your young adulthood. We'll go back to yesterday. We'll go back to this morning. We'll tell you how you got there. You are at where you are right now because of your experiences. Well, psychology was dealing with that on that level of operation and has been dealing with it as a premise for a long, long time. Jung introduced two different kinds of thoughts here. He said, yes, certainly, what we are now is what we indeed have been, what we have experienced. But there's something far beyond that. Part of it is also what we're going to. Now, there is, in other words, not only a pushing effect that has brought us to where we are, but there is a pulling effect out there someplace. Now, if this sounds suspiciously like theology, you're probably right. There are some of these resemblances. But Jung, unlike, let's say, for example, some Christian theology, which says, well, God has a plan for us toward which he is drawing us. That would be one, what we call a teleological pull. If you want a fancy word, you want to impress your roommates when you get back home, you say teleological pull. It's that future thing that is drawing us to it. God out there in the future. Or when they thought they destroyed God with the origin of the species, some took Darwin's interpretation and said, well, we'll get rid of God, but we can't get rid of the idea, so we'll put a divine, Mother Nature out there, that we are evolving towards some sort of a perfect state. Well, although that is what we think of in terms of a teleological pull, Jung did not quite mean that. He said there is indeed something within us which is pulling us toward self-realization, which is pulling us toward an achievement of what we can be. He said all of us have that dynamic built into us. And it is indeed a distant goal, but in some way the seeds are already in us. So now Jung introduced that. And by the way, this is not a very popular notion with many of the hard-nosed empiricist scientists, and especially psychologists, and especially of the American strain. They don't like this. They like causality. They like determinism, but they don't like that kind of pulling out to a future that may have indeed something, some sort of an aura of magnetism about it, that we are being drawn to this. Jung says, no, let's be open to this, because each of us knows that what happens in our present circumstance is a function, oftentimes, of goals. I teach college classes, and I have often wondered, as I looked at these kids, how many of them would be there today on this gorgeous, beautiful day when all their chemistry is running full within them, and they'd much rather be with a luscious girl if they happen to be male, or with a luscious man if they happen to be female, out somewhere on the grass, I suppose. And yet they're here in this somewhat stuffy classroom listening to me. How many of them would be here if they didn't have that great BA in the sky to draw them, you know, out there? Well, all right, Jung introduced that notion, and he said we must take this seriously. But he introduced yet another, and this one is a most mysterious thing. He said each of us not only is determined by our personal background, much of which, by the way, is unconscious. We are not conscious of many things within our personal background, but we are reflections of our personal experience. We are reflections on the way we were punished or on the way we were rewarded, on whether we had a benign adult taking care of us or an abusive one when we were small. Yes, we are all that. But those are all submerged, more or less. We're not conscious of them, but we behave according to them. But Jung said, yes, there is something yet in back of this, and that is that we behave according to our inheritance as members of the human race, that are the human condition, the human species, has developed kind of common experiences, significant common experiences. We'll talk about that hopefully this morning, we can get off this introduction. That somehow work into your very inheritance. Now, this is something like translating or transmitting memory from one to the other. That somehow, let's say that when your parents conceived you, they not only conceived you as a biological being, but they transmitted experiences to you that they in turn received from the prior generations. That's a very tough thing to deal with. And again, the hardcore empiricists in the United States, in the psychological enterprise, said that's nonsense. Well, somehow it's an ironic thing that we're beginning to revisit this thing. We're beginning to revisit the notion, is it possible to transmit memories from generation to generation. Fellow by the name of McConnell at the University of Michigan did some interesting little things about planarians, little worms. He taught some planarians to respond to a light, to go over to the light side, because he gave them a shock when they were on the dark side of the tank, and they wriggled over to the light side. And finally they began, whenever he turned on the light, they went over to that light side to be protected from the shock on the dark side. And they did it very well. So what he did then was he sacrificed them on the altar of science, ground them up, picked out, hopefully, since they're very simple creatures, he hoped that whatever RNA, that memory factor that comes, would be in some sense within that ground up stuff, and he fed these to other planarians, other little fish, and they could gobble, gobble, gobble. Then he went over there, he turned on the light, and he watched. How often would these planarians go over there follow the light to avoid a shock that they never received? And the interesting thing was that he began to get significant results. That those planarians, there were other planarians who received ground-up fellow planarians who never learned this trick about going over to this place to avoid a shock, and they didn't do nearly as well. In fact, they did miserably. They just stayed there, they just floated around and enjoyed their little planarian aquarium, I suppose. But the ones who ate their fellows, who had learned this, seemed on a statistically significant level to go over to the light more often. And now this began to open up the question, is it possible that we do indeed have memories transmitted from a prior generation to this generation? If so, what is the nature of them? Well, Jung, 50, 60 years ago, was saying we inherit memories from prior generations. And what happens is that we are not in tune with them. They have force on us right now, but we're not acknowledging that force, and we need to. Well, okay, let's see what we have so far. We're talking about how we process this world, and we're talking about, are we in touch with those sources of knowledge, both in terms of what we are being drawn to, and in terms of what he called the collective unconscious? Are we in touch with those? Now, if we can do that this morning, we'll be doing marvelously well, because I want you to talk back. You may talk back, and we'll see what can happen as we go along. Basically, Jung says the way we process this world. He said there are four ways. We can think the world. He said there are two rational processes and two non-rational processes. We can think the world and we can feel the world. Now, by thinking and feeling, he had his own little definitions, which is always annoying. You always hope that he would take the Slip magazine definitions or the dictionary definitions. But he said we can think the world, we can feel the world. Now, by thinking and feeling, he had his own little definitions, which is always annoying. You always hope that he would take the Slip magazine definitions or the dictionary definitions. But he said, we can think the world, we can feel the world. The thinking of the world is what we most of us understand as thinking. Analysis, causality, determination. How do we process this world on an analytic point of view? He said this is a very popular way of processing the world. It's a very popular way in societies which have as a value materialism. The analytic factor, of course, is our great inheritance from the Greeks. We've heard about this again and again, almost to the point that we hope that it wouldn't be repeated. But that way of processing the world, analysis, being able to take a thing apart, put it and reintegrate it again, marvelous. This is how this came about, this building. It's how plumbing came about. We thank the Greeks for our plumbing. Even though they didn't invent it, they gave us the mode for how to do it, because man, in his capacity to take apart this world and reintegrate it, to analyze it and to resynthesize it, has been able to transform much of the material world into new and startling products, so much so impressively that we, as I said earlier, have begun to think that science can answer all of our questions. But Jung said also there's another way of processing this world, another function, and that is on feeling. A feeling is basically what we could imagine as what we could call value. This thing is good, this is bad, that's beautiful, that's ugly, whatever the case may be. Now, keep in mind that what often happens in a growing personality is that one of these functions, and there are two more yet to be announced, becomes the favorite one. He called it a superior function. And he said the rest of them kind of get dimmed out. They're available for us, but we tend not to use them. And only one of them tends to be in our consciousness. That is, we can be a thinker, but we tend not to be a feeler, or, now what are the other two? Well, the other two are what he would call sensing, and that is just simply bringing in the world to ourselves, allowing it, it's a kind of a establishment of what is out there. It doesn't do what thinking does, which tries to put relationships two and two together or whatever the case may be. It just simply allows the world to come in. And the other one is intuition. Intuition is a kind of, it's been a weak term. We oftentimes have said intuition, that's womanly intuition, as if that's, that shows weakness. Well, intuition, he was saying there are ways that we get to underlying structures of things without thinking our way through them. We see them and we say, I know the answer to that. And if someone would say, tell me how you got there, we would say, I don't know. I know the solution, but I don't know how I know the solution. I see the structure, but I don't know how I got there. Now, where can we go from here? These functions work. Let me say this. Another point that I want to say. In our materialistic world, this analysis is a very useful thing, and we've tended to downgrade the others. And as a matter of fact, when the others happen in other people, we don't always understand them. For example, the thinking husband whose wife comes to him and talks about how she is processing something on a feeling level, it's almost impossible for the husband to understand this. Tell me how you got to that conclusion. And she tries to tell something about her feelings in an analytic way, and it doesn't work. And he can't understand her, and she can't oftentimes understand him. In the history of our society, the kind of society in which we live, this thinking process has been a great thing in terms of survival. It aids us in our survival tremendously. And in a sense, the intuiting and the sensing and the feeling are kinds of things that maybe in terms of our survival, somewhat like luxuries. And it's getting to be an interesting thing to me. It just occurred to me as I was going through this. Maybe this might account for some of the gap between generations, where we're dealing right now with a generation perhaps who has not had to face the problem of need or of want or of privation so much, because our society has found ways for us to at least establish the primary need level of saying we got enough food, we got enough to drink, and we got a house over our head. There have been very few generations in history that have succeeded as well in conquering the material world as we have. Now what happens, however, when we don't have that burden of making it imposed on our new generation? Might they not slip into some of these other functions? And of course, we think almost immediately of the sensate level, of the sensing level. Let's feel it at our fingertips. Let's take life not in terms of, am I going to make it through this next day or the next year or the next 10 years, but let's live life, since I don't have to ask that question, I know there will be food on the table, there will be a job to occupy, there will be a roof over my head, I have time for other things. There may be slippages into different kinds, some of these other functions. And we find indeed that's what is happening, is that there is much more living on the intuitive level and on the sensate level and on the feeling level by many of our youth. They do not respond as well on the analytic level. As many people who teach college know this very, very well, the capacity for analysis of a college student coming into a classroom and being given a task to analyze something is seen to have been eroded. And of course this is oftentimes blamed on the lack of basic education. You know, they're doing a rotten job in the grade schools and high schools, and here we poor people in the college have to confront this sort of bad teaching on the back. It may be far more profound than that. It may be that indeed that kind of functioning that we have held to be important, the analytic function, the thinking function, is much less important to the youth of the day. That they say, no, there are ways of dealing with this world. That I can go out, the capacity to appreciate the outdoors or to appreciate artistic things, after all, is not typically on the analytic level. It is more on the level of the intuitive, or the feeling, or the sensating. But Jung comes to us and says, O thou who have depended so much on the analytic, you who are getting into your 30s and 40s and who have come through this tradition, learn also from the youth. Learn that these are available to you. They are yet undiscovered, but they're there. They are within you. Can you indeed learn them? Well, Jung says even something more. He says, there is a time in life where we come, that place called the Grand Middle Age, where now the struggle is pretty well over in terms of vocation, bearing and raising children, a kind of value system that has helped us through all this, and all of a sudden we find out the kick has gone out of life. What have we got left? What is there besides this? Is that all there is, as that song by Peggy Lee used to say years ago? Is that all there is? Is that it? Will we just pace now or mark time until we die? The word ennui has become almost more than a crossword puzzle word. In fact, when I first saw ennui, I thought, what in the world is that? That's a funny name. I thought it was an African animal first. But ennui, that feeling of pointlessness, lack of meaning. What is life to live? It's the kick has gone off. The kids are grown. They're out of the home. And that humming rhythm and activity that I've been depending on, that I've gotten so used to and learned to love, is now gone. Well, Jung says, all right, here are ways now. There are things about you that are yet to be discovered, that you have been functioning on only one level. That this functioning, this capacity to function on a larger level is there, but it's going to take a little risk, because most of us have controlled ourselves, and our little control perhaps consists of whatever is happening on that quarter inch just right around our cerebral cortex. And if we kick that off, we get to the whoopee stage, you know, as any of you who take a cocktail hour know how that happens. You know, where does the alcohol work? It works on that little quarter of an inch. That's all it is. And all of a sudden we find ourselves how small or how short the distance is between our inhibitions and our wearing lampshades on our heads and being the life of the party. All right, he says, most of us don't like that notion. Most of us don't like the image of lampshades on our head. And we get uncomfortable with that notion. But Jung says, and the reason for it is that we don't like the risk, the embarrassment, because our categories have all been built up to saying these are prescribed ways of behaving. And Jung is calling us to say, you better learn how to behave on a broader level. You better learn how to be silly. You better learn how to touch and to feel, to become sensate again, like indeed the little baby is only a sensate creature, or to live by hunch and not only by intellect, because these are avenues, these are potential possibilities for us to get to. Well, those are what he would call functions. He hooks them onto two basic attitudes. The attitudes, and here you can, all those of you who have indeed gone to cocktail parties and have talked Freud and complexes and Jung and his contribution, you may have done it unwittingly. He talks about extroversion, introversion. Oh, we know the extroverted personality, you know, the glad hander, the salesman type. We all know the extrovert. And we all know the introvert, the scholarly guy who would rather hole up and be inside of a room and away from people. Did Jung mean that? Yes and no. Which is the best possible stupid answer I can give you right now. But there's more to it. I can give you a little bit better answer than just a dumb one like that. Yes, there is more to it. There is more to the extrovert. The extrovert believes that his reality and his value sits outside of himself, is outside of himself, and that his focus will indeed be on the outside world. The introvert, on the other hand, finds that his values are basically on the inward side. Well, then, isn't that just what we were talking about, the salesman and the scholar? That not quite. Because you might find a person who's basically introverted, who becomes so wrapped up in an idea that he might be quite willing to defend it on any level. Like, for example, in a heated argument, which is an extroverted activity. He doesn't just simply stay in his little cubicle, but he might go out and defend his argument, but still be an introverted person. Because his value system is basically inside of himself and focusing on the things that are in the world. Now let's see whether that are in his inner world. Let's see if we could just pick up a few things here in terms of then, if we latch introversion and extroversion to thinking, feeling, sensing, and intuiting, you come out to about 8 different types. Now these are types of personality. Jung says, in the final analysis, every one of these types is inadequate. And as a matter of fact, if we make progress in discovering ourself, we make progress in a sense, getting rid of these types. By the way, some people would say 8 types are simply inadequate to describe the human condition. That shouldn't hold us down right here, because I think these are useful ways of looking at the human condition, and we don't have to get hung up on whether there are other kinds of ways of looking at the human type or at the human condition. But Jung says, all right, these are types, but they are all inadequate. They are all inadequate because they do not take advantage of the other functions, for one thing, nor do they take advantage of the other attitude, whether if you happen to be introverted, to be take advantage of the extrovert. For example, let's just play with the introverted side. To be an introverted thinker, what does that mean? Or to be an introverted, have an introverted feeling, what does that mean? Or an introverted sensation, or sensing, or an introverted intuition. Just briefly, an introverted thinker might, for example, just love pure math. Just as one 19th century mathematician was supposed to say, I finally came to a theoretical structure of math that those dadgum physicists will never be able to use. Well, the notion of saying it's precious because it doesn't have any practical value. How many people have you met that way, you know, have said, well, let's just think of the thing itself. Doesn't have any practical value. Well, a pure introverted thinker is very much like that. I love the idea so much. I love theology. I don't care what it means in terms of my day-by-day life, but I love theology. That's great. Or, as we were saying the other day, I love humanity, but that guy over there who's holding out the pencils in his cap, too bad. Or the introverted feeling, where the values that we are sensing are the internal values, the things that we feel are significant, are so important to us that we can't deal with them, that we cannot deal with the external values, the other side, those values which are outside, except by a critical reaction. If that sounds a little fuzzy, Jung is not all that clear. I'm just pretending that he is in order to do this thing with you. For some of these things are he does allow a little fuzz on the edges that would not satisfy any technical philosopher I know. Or what about introverted sensation? Isn't all sensation, when we take in the world as it is, isn't it all external? Isn't it all an extroverted thing instead of an introverted thing? How can you deal with introverted sensation? Well, I think what is meant here is that we take the sensations and immediately retranslate them into something within ourselves. For example, let's think of an artist who will take a sensation, his sensations, and immediately filter them through his own system of meanings and pour out for you, whether it's music or whether it's a piece of art or even literature for that matter, pour out for you how those retranslated values will seem. It's a very strongly personal-oriented value system that will take anything that is coming in on a sensate level and immediately reprocess it. This is what interesting thing one of the great reformers in American education says, that if we want to really reform our educational system, or if we want to reform society, he said, don't listen, and here, Larry, forgive me, don't listen necessarily to the political scientists or to the ethicist necessarily, or even the philosopher. If you want to reform society and want to have a vision of what it is, go to your poets. Go to your poets. Those who take the present meaning, and I think I hear a little bit of what also Walt was saying this morning, because maybe it is the poets who are the prophets of our time, the ones who can take what is happening to us and reprocess it. Introverted intuition, going beyond and behind the facts about the inner world that the sensation comes to. That, again, I would say, trying to explain what intuition is, which we all perceive, I think on a functional level, I think we all know what the intuition might indeed be, is like using another function, you know, the analytic function to explain this thing, to give us an image, an idea of what it is by a process that has absolutely no relationship to it, is a kind of a strange, paradoxical, and funny thing. It's an impossible thing. We can talk about extroverted thinking, extroverted feeling, extroverted sensation, and extroverted intuition, but I'm not going to, unless you just beg me, and then of course I'll accede and say, of course, I'll tell you what these are as I understand them. Because I think this notion of functioning, of how we function in the world, of being perhaps intuitors or feelers or sensate people or thinkers, gives us a little bit of a hint of what this undiscovered self is up to. And whether we have our value system basically in an internal-wise way, or that we find our meaning and our value outside of ourselves, can pretty well begin to tell us where we would fit in these various categories. Now, I had planned at this time to say, maybe I should pause here. In fact, I even put down someplace down, pause, a dramatic pause, and it says pause for discussion, which is absolutely pre-programmed. I almost feel vulnerable to Bill Lehman's accusation that I'm a behaviorist. Now I've got you programmed. It says, according to my program, you discuss. I don't know whether any of you want to throw in something at this point, because there is another gear ratio now that we're still going into, and that is the relationship to the unconscious. But anyone want to say something while I sip tea? Yeah.
I'm going to ask a question.
Oh, I hope you ask a good one, which means the kind that I can answer.
I wanted to know if there's where a second, what I think is a second kind of thinking fits with your Jung's category of thinking, feeling, sensate, intuition. Mm-hmm. In the history of science, most of the major discoveries, the breakthroughs in science, have not been by pursuing an analytical mode. That's
very good.
The second step. The first step is staring hard at the obvious until you see it in a different way. It's a leap of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of seeing things in a new pattern is sometimes referred to as a kind of thinking,
mm-hmm.
as an imaginative thinking.
Yeah.
Now, is that what you call, or Jung calls, intuition or the hunch?
Very good. It is a good question, because it's a very fundamental kind of question. One of my favorite anecdotes in respect to how do we find answers to things comes from a personal account by Albert Einstein, who was confronting a theoretical problem in mathematics where the determinants were all there in front of his nose, but he didn't know how to reconceptualize them to give him the kind of more powerful theory that he needed to have done. And he said, I'd struggle with it, and finally out of despair go to sleep and wake up only to have the solution sweetly present itself. Mm-hmm. Well, this operates on two levels. He probably was working too hard on the analytic level, on the thinking level. Now, how to get into the intuitive level, that which makes the improbable leap, that which is not justified by everything in front of your nose, that is not justified in terms of the components right there, how to make that jump, the improbable jump that gave us this enormously powerful theory of relativity to displace, or at least to expand, well, displace, I think, Newtonian physics. How did that happen? Well, he tapped into intuition, but he had to have help. In the first instance, it was just simply sleep. It was just simply sleep. And what did that mean? He turned off his head. He turned off his brain. He found that when he stopped trying to process this through a function that was finally not paying, that relationship somehow began to change. Now, the next question is, what are the mechanisms of that change? And here, let me say quite modestly, psychology doesn't have an answer. But Jung, except if you believe such a guy as Jung, who would say he was beginning to move into a pool of personal experience, his personal unconscious. This has nothing to do with the collective unconscious of the history of the race. But he was dipping into his pool of relationships also forgotten long time ago. And how much of what we do has not been forgotten? Many of the good things, you know, like the farmer says, I'm not farming nearly as well as I know how. Well, we are not living our life nearly as well as we know how in terms of all the good thoughts, the good feelings, the good things that we were doing and have done, but we haven't put them all together. Now, how do we dip into that? Well, we dip into it by, in a sense, letting ourselves go, letting this filtering system called the analytic mode, just let it go. Now, as I said, we can do that in several ways. We can go into our fantasies. We can go into sleep like Einstein. We can doodle. We can do artistic work. Forget it entirely. Or just play with ridiculous ideas. The nonsensical ideas. Great. Do so. See, Jung provides us with the notion that maybe what he was doing was achieving access where many of us have not tapped. Now, all of us are able to achieve access to these places. We may not have quite the the great central nervous system that Einstein had. I mean, he had a terrific central nervous system. I wish we would have it pickled right now so we could look at it and say, is there anything about that we can learn? But he had a great, that powerful head of his, you know, and then yet the greater capacity not to fear other aspects of his life, even if it would be what we could call childish aspects. You see, we have grown up so much in the notion that grown-up behavior is the thinking analytic behavior that we forget that we are, that the child within us, or I don't want to use that that too strongly, but that other aspects of us, the dreamer, and all that stuff is available to us yet. If we wouldn't all get rid of that terrible, burden that most of us carry, and which the Germans, and I'm from a German tradition, epitomize so well in that saying, "Was wollen die Leute sagen?" What are people going to say? You know, and we live under that burden of saying, what people say if I come up with a silly thought? Or how many of us can remember the sting of that in our own childhood when some adult said to our response, that's a silly thought, or that's silly, or, you know, just dismiss it. How can we recapture that? The great thinkers of the world have gone into some sort of repristination, which they have captured that. That's too long of a response to a very good question.
One thing just about every role may encourage to create.
Oh yeah, sure.
We talked somewhat about this process, that it did start with an analytic process, that the information was there, he fed through it, but as the idea just didn't come without that. But then as that process was drawn, everything came together from it, but yeah. The analytic process gave material.
I hope that's from a tomb and not from heaven.
I just wanted to add one thing too, that how that comes about, sin isn't complete, but just simply changing of activity and even doing something like, I just been thinking, like doing dishes.
Mm-hmm.
That when we are so automated, we talk about technology as being detrimental to the environment, you know, at least to some degrees, if it goes too far, it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of it, certain kinds of technology being detrimental to opening our lives to that kind of thinking. I know women have said, and I don't iron at all, but women who iron have said how much thinking they get done while ironing.
Yes.
Anyway, that these kinds of places in our life to not always be actively performing, even performing recreation, sometimes we do that so with so much work.
This is a good statement of on target thinking. I sit usually through all three sessions in the morning, and one of the best activities I can do is go and wash dishes. You know, it's not only an altruistic thing when I end up in the dish line after the first setting, but I do it so that I can wash myself clean, so I can revisit some of the things that have been said in a fresh way. Incidentally, this great educational reformer said not only poets, but he said artists. He said, watch for the poets and the artists, the ones who can give us, who have the power to trust their inner experiences in a way that offer us a way of looking at this world that has been denied us to ourselves by ourselves. I'm a little hung up. I know what's going to be happening here. This whole next section is, in a sense, an even more promising section in terms of how do we relate to the unconscious, what's the nature of that, and what is meant by collective unconscious. But I think we need perhaps a little bit more time at this stage of the game than we have available to us. So I think, should I hurry it? And then maybe we could have a continuation of this on Monday, because I don't think it's going to be able to be handled. There is a, right now, where this is in a sense prelude, even though these functions are extremely important, these functions and these attitudes are to understand. Do any of you have any questions yet that you'd like to throw in on this thing, to either for your own understanding of it or whatever? May I? Yes, please.
When you said it's so hard to separate the four, because it seems as though we normally run out of blend, when you say that most people have a preference for one, is that a good thing or just a matter of half the people? Would it be better that we kind of equally balance out the four, if there is such a thing as better?
Yes. Ultimately, we do, or as we achieve self-realization, we do balance out our functions. We tend to use them more than one of the functions. But as a matter of fact, I think it's kind of useful for us to understand too that many people have been able to do this before they reach the middle age. Not all of us are going to have to wait until being confronted by the middle age crisis before we're forced into examining these options. The best of us, the best of any society or of any collection of people, have those who have dealt comfortably with all of these functions and dealing, but at their appropriate time. There is a time to be analytic, an appropriate event in toward which we can be analytic. It's appropriate at times to be intuitive and not being embarrassed about it, or to be sensate and not be embarrassed about that. Yeah, that to live comfortably, to learn how to live comfortably with these functions, to live comfortably in the inner world, but also then to live comfortably with the outer world. The one, for example, the one living comfortably on the outer world theologically might be comfortable best of all in symbols or in rituals. But there is more to the experience, the spiritual experience, as it were, than just simple symbols and rituals. It's not that they're inappropriate, but they are only part. They are only part of what our total experience can be. Some would tend to make that the only thing. That the trappings, for example, of religiosity, of being religious, is the thing, is the essence of the religious experience. But others, the notion of breaking out from that, to breaking out into also the intuitive response. And I oftentimes think, too, that perhaps the charismatic movement might be simply a demonstration of starvation, in the sense of the psychological starvation, in terms of too much of an analytic or thinking way of doing with religion. The human condition is more than that. We of course have our rituals, and we do have our common worship experiences. We do have we have dogma, and for that, again, we're thankful. It's again Walt's favorite statement: the dogma is a man's best friend. Terrible pun. It almost stretched our relationship to the point of breaking when he first said it then. But see, we do have all of these components of the religious experience, but we tend to focus on one. We tend, for example, some would tend to focus on the religious experience primarily on a highly subjective, introverted level, without being able to also partake of the benefits of theological discourse, for example, or the benefits of collective worship, and say, well, no, the only worship that is necessary is small group worship. There's a big push on this now. Herman Mayer at Seminex is pushing the notion of small group worship as being perhaps a redemptive factor. I hope he's saying a corrective factor rather than a redemptive one, because there's a world of a difference. But the human condition does as it comes down to us individually, we do need the impulse relationship also with our Lord. We do need the praying intently in small groups. We do need the cathedrals. We do need, perhaps, although I don't think so as strongly, we do need the prayer chapels. I have a little problem with that, you know, where you concretize your subjective experience and say, here's where you'd be subjective, right in a small little place. But we do need these, as we need sometimes individual confession, which we've lost. So many of the good things that have happened in the history of the Christian experience, we have somehow learned how to deny ourselves. Those from a Lutheran tradition, for example, are a little uncomfortable about having confession, individual confession, going to the pastor and confessing individually, or the sign of the cross, you know. Those are all gifts to us. But somehow we do the thing that Jung is talking about. We tend to focus on a function or on a combination of function and attitude, which then begins to exclude so many valid experiences for us, so many experiences that are part of the great gifts that God has given us, I think not only in creation, of course, but in the history. All things are open to us. You know, it's almost like Jung is proclaiming the gospel, is saying, we are liberated into it all, but the captor is not anyone except yourself, in a sense. The potential is there. What you going to do about it? Yeah, okay.
And is there a difference, though, between that which is in the well-being of the individual, a balancing of various functions and development of various potentialities in a balanced way, the difference between that and that which actually often moves society as a whole along? If one thinks of the great contributors to society, I think of a lot of people that whom one would not characterize as well-balanced in terms of those functions. They've been kind of eccentric genius. I mean, yeah. I doubt that a Luther would match up, or a Kierkegaard, or a Paul Klee, or even an Einstein.
Yeah.
It may be that the contributions to society are in some tension with that which is contributing for the well-being of the individual.
Yeah, that's again a very thoughtful comment. The high focus, we cannot deny that that mankind, for example, has benefited very much from people who have brought a high focus to one of these functions. And they themselves may not be fully self-realized persons, to use the jargon that Jung bestowed upon us, but indeed have been the very narrow-gauge producers of a gift.
It may be a corrective for society. It may be a dimension of society.
Yes, indeed.
is a balancing for society.
Yes, yes, yeah. Right. And they may be what another good friend of mine, Ralph Gehrke, used to call curmudgeons. He's a real curmudgeon, meaning he's probably, he's a rotten guy, but he reproduces it. And I suppose that in some way or another he really produces. I suppose that we don't always find these marvelous put-together people who are also the great contributors. Sometimes we do. I oftentimes think that we can look, we have these divine exceptions, these marvelous people who have put it all together and have been at the same time productive that we should be terribly grateful for. Yes, Lionel.
You know, I've come across mentally retired people of all ages, you know, from children to very old people.
Yeah.
And it's some kind, it's a striking reality because it's so physical, it's so visual, and they seem to be so exceptionally honest with themselves as they are, you know, mm-hmm. as they are composed. And I think in terms of what we've been talking about, this, you know, this well-blended sort of sense that we could, you know, take hold of and learn from each, you know, aspect of it. And I'm beginning to think that, you know, maybe I've always wondered why there are mentally retarded people. I mean, I'm not at all familiar with the physical aspects of mentally retarded, just what I've experienced in terms of what they're like as people. And I'm wondering, you know, how that stuff has anything to do with it, or if they're just the type of people that are just overwhelmed by all of them at once. And so I don't know if they have that capacity to think analytically, which maybe is the difference between us and those that are.
But there are other functions that would be available to them,
yeah.
which we can learn to respect. Mm-hmm. And I've often, when Leo Bustad talked about that remarkable place in Germany, this Bethel Valley, valley with the 5,000, this Bright Valley of Hope, that, where it's represented, the 5,000 severely retarded and the 5,000 normal people. And how the director of this took time each day to be with someone. And you think, how altruistic. But I would have a bet that that director was a very put-together man who would say also, I learn from you. You know, you expand me, you do things for me in your way, with your functioning. And here again, the functioning also in Jungian terms, you know, that here I've got command of my world, I can process it, I can analyze it, but you are doing it a different way, and I can watch that, and I can appreciate it, and love you for benefiting me from it. It's not a sentimental dodge, you know, to say I can learn from anyone. But indeed, here is a way that we can learn from some of these whom we thought are the handicapped. And they may not be so handicapped in terms of offering us ways that if I were denied an analytic function, if I would be denied my thought processes that are called normal, would I be able to live? And I think Jung opens up possibilities for hope. Because what is the alternative? Well, the alternative could be Hitler saying, knock those kids off, you know, kill them. Why? Because they're not functioning. They're on the level that I think functioning should be. Well, he's missing out on all these other marvelous functioning processes, which we, ironically, have to go back and recapture. We have to become mentally handicapped to become psychologically whole. It's one of those paradoxes. And I think we're going to leave it at this point because I had the impression we're going to have a descent of people in here where we're going to grab chairs, but there is they're asking us to honor a schedule, a rather rigid schedule today. We'll see about whether we can, whether I might shift gears. Split Brain was going to be next week, but I think I can still use this as a prelude to the Split Brain stuff.